Hello, everyone. I hope everyone is receiving us because I am trying a new solution when we have guests, which is StreamYard. I believe we should be live on Odyssey right now. How are you doing, people of the regular chat? Thank you for being here. And I'm super happy to have someone who has been requested on the show for a long time, but I've been delaying his invite because simply I have no more guests. But I was certainly willing to make an exception for him. He is a right-wing thinker, an identitarian thinker of Twitter, a Twitter philosopher of sorts, a YouTuber who has an amazing YouTube channel, Joel Davis videos on YouTube. And he is with us tonight to talk about all sorts of things, including what's happening on the internet, what's happening to the identitarian movements for white people, and Australian politics. How are you doing, Joel?
Yeah, it's great to be on the show. Long-time watcher. I remember actually a guy who's been on your show before, way back in the day, True Dill Tom.
Oh, yeah.
He and I actually were roommates years ago. And I remember he was preparing to come onto your show with Richard Spencer like 4 or 5 years ago. And he was like calling me on the phone one night. I'm going on JF show with Richard tomorrow. What am I going to say? And we were like, you know, wargaming it out. Like, this is before I got into podcasting or streaming or anything. Long time viewer of the show. So it's fun to finally be on.
Well, it's crazy for me to be thinking about this, that we were linked to each other without me realizing it. I mean, I knew about you because I had seen you on all these interviews that you make on so many podcasts, but to think that that even before you started on the internet, you had a roommate who I interviewed. My God, I'm becoming old at this point. Makes me feel old. So how has it been, this career that you started? I guess you started a little late with respect to the great rise of the right in 2016.
Yeah, I was just kind of a somewhat passive observer who hung out in as an anon in chats and dark corners of the internet and so on, reading books and even on Facebook back then, back when you could be a dissident on Facebook, back in like 2016, 2017 era, you could say, yeah, you could get away with it back then. There were these big, you know, right-wing Facebook groups and so on. But obviously that really got destroyed after Charlottesville, in particular, when the censorship really got turned up to an extra degree. And so the way that I got into this was, I just mentioned True Dill Tom. So he was a guy that I befriended, and we lived in the same city. So we befriended each other through online politics, and then we hung out in real life and so on. He had a big YouTube channel. And we used to talk. I used to say, you know, I fancied myself as I could advise him philosophically on my views and so on. And he seemed receptive. And then he said, why don't we do a podcast together? I'll publish it on YouTube. And I thought, okay, I'll give it a go. And so we started doing a few podcasts and I kind of got a feel for it. And it wasn't like I had to start out from scratch. It had a large audience already. So that kind of felt good, that it was like you're making a product that people are actually listening to. And not long after we started doing that, though, he abruptly decided to just delete his channel and just leave the scene entirely. He's since like de-radicalized, I believe. Like, he's not even he's an anti-racist now, or he's not racist anymore or whatever. And he just wants to be a normie. But so then after I'd kind of, you know, gotten into it and then he abruptly left, I kind of wanted to continue. So then I started my own channel, and my channel was more focused on philosophy and, you know, really kind of abstract kind of theory, as opposed to like covering the news or covering kind of you know, major developments or whatever in politics. It was very, very, as I said, very theory focused and philosophy focused. Like, I had like whole streams where I'd have this like big group call and we'd read like Kant's Critique of Judgment, and I'd pump videos out of us discussing that and so on. It was very niche content. But over time, I started to refine it and started to kind of direct it more. And I guess since I started doing that, I've had probably more success and more prominence in the scene. So the last couple of years, I've been more of a conventional, I still talk about theory a lot, but I've been more of a kind of conventional political theory streamer, political news streamer, and so on. So
now it's amazing how hard it has become to rise, because with your level of fame, if do minus 5 years, let's say you do the same thing 5 years ago, you wouldn't have 8,800 subscribers on YouTube. You may have 100K already. But YouTube has been totally shunned. It has been dampened, and you can't have as much success as you used to. But in a way, what's happening at Twitter is very encouraging. You were banned on Twitter, right?
Yeah, I was banned in 2021. And
you came back recently.
Yeah, very recently. I only benefited from the amnesty, I think, 19 days ago. So,
okay.
Yeah, so
that's been good. So how have you been feeling on Twitter with the new administration under Elon?
Oh, it's great. I mean, in the 19 days since I came back, I just checked my analytics, and it said I had 1.1 million impressions in 19 days. So that's pretty good. And all my stuff is like Jewish question stuff, white identity stuff. Like, I'm not pulling any punches whatsoever. So it's very encouraging that that kind of content you can go balls to the wall with now. And yeah, like the moderation is so much more lax than it was. There seems to be institutional targeting, I guess, because of outside pressure groups. So I noticed like all the patriotic alternative guys in Britain, they got brought back, and then abruptly they all got all banned together in one go, obviously, because maybe someone in the some NGO in Britain or some element of the British deep state or something may have lent on Twitter and kind of got them taken out. And I know the National Justice Party people are victims of the same thing. Nick Fuentes was brought back for like a day, and then obviously they decided that they didn't want to do that. So some people are simply too hot to be platformed, but a large portion of the movement is allowed back. Obviously, you and I have been allowed back, and many other people. So obviously the situation is vastly improved, and also the moderation is so much more lax. Like, I've seen a lot of accounts posting the N-word and getting away with it and so on. It's just so much, it's so much more freedom for us to express, our views. So yeah, it's very encouraging. I feel like if this continues down this trajectory, for a year or so, the amount of momentum that we'll be able to build will hopefully be like a 2016 like, energy, because, and we're so much more mature as a movement now. We're more refined. Our talking points are better. So we can actually take a lot more advantage of a situation like that than we did back then. And but the big threat, I posted about this recently on Twitter, actually, which is that there is currently a court case. People don't really know about this very well. That's going to go before the Supreme Court. It's backed by the ADL, which is against Twitter. And basically, the argument is that they're trying to suspend the Section 230 protections that Twitter has, basically that protected against liability for what people post on the site. And they're trying to suspend it with the Anti-Terrorism Act by arguing that some ISIS people had accounts on Twitter like 9 years ago, and they were recruiting people to ISIS on Twitter, and therefore this should suspend Section 230 because they blew up some, you know, bus in Jordan or something, and an American citizen got grievously injured or something. And so they've built this whole convoluted case, which is obviously directed. Like, if you read the opinion given to the court by the ADL, it's very clear to me that their perspective on this is they don't really care about the ISIS thing. They just want to create this legal hole in Section 230 so that they can just lobby shitloads of lawsuits at Twitter to try and take down quote-unquote white supremacist extremist content. And you can even see them mention white supremacy in their opinion. Why would it even be relevant to ISIS? But they mentioned their opinion to the court. And so it's very clear that's what they're going for. So it's a big decision. The Supreme Court is, I think, about to give a ruling on it any day now. And so hopefully Twitter emerges victorious from that legal battle, because if they lose, that could potentially ruin our fun here.
I've been following this case. There's a couple of interesting cases around Section 230, which has been terrible in terms of its application and interpretation. And yet the intent and the law was very clear. You are a channel, you are a tube when you are an internet operator, and you're not responsible for people swimming in your tube and doing whatever crime they want. And it makes total sense from a mens rea perspective. Elon Musk cannot be responsible for even my extremist content if it was to make someone else extremist and commit a terrorist act. Elon Musk cannot be held responsible for this, and it makes total sense. But yeah, the forces of the left have been going strong at it, wanting to undermine this. And their exception, of course, is for white supremacy. And that's always their target. That's what they've succeeded at doing by banning people like me for excuses like spam. But they were getting at me because of my racial identity and my opinions on heterosexuality. So when you went into dissident movement, was it being influenced by True Delta, being influenced by your own interactions on the internet? And when you went with your face publicly, was it the choice of dissidence, a choice of living as an outcast for the rest of your life? Or was it something that you experience as simply you sharing your views and it doesn't bother you in your everyday life?
Yeah, well, I was quote-unquote red-pilled around 2014, 2015. So this was long. Like, I think I became friends with Dylan in maybe early 2018, maybe late 2017, around then. I can't remember exactly. So I was already quite red-pilled by that time. I got red-pilled with the original rise of the alt-right. I went through a bit of a libertarian phase, and then there were all of these conduits from that. I remember arguing about gun rights in like late 2014 on Facebook when I was like a libertarian. And then like, in order to win the argument, I had to appeal to race realism to say that, oh, well, there actually isn't any correlation in American states between different states and their gun laws and the severity of gun crime, but it correlates perfectly with the concentration of the black population because they have high crime rates. And then people say, oh, well, that's because of socioeconomic factors. And it's like, well, no, actually it's because IQ is genetic. And so this sent me down a pathway towards race realism. And once you start going down that pathway, then that just opens a whole new section of the internet, as well as there was like Nia at the time, like kind of rethinking democracy, and obviously like Jewish power kind of memes and ideas floating around. And I found all of that seductive and kind of got pulled in around that time. And then then after kind of the initial wave of the alt-right kind of petered out somewhat, Charlottesville happened and things kind of shit really hit the fan after that. The Trump administration didn't turn out like anyone thought or hoped that it would, and so on. Then I became kind of more introspective, more philosophically focused, and trying to think about the problem more abstractly, maybe too abstractly for some time, over-intellectualizing things. But that was a very useful period of my life because went through a lot of intellectual development and hopefully dragged some people through intellectual development with me through my online presence. But I decided to show my real face and name because I wanted to take the power away from the enemy to dox me and so on. I have a kind of a martyrdom streak, I guess, that I always had ever since I was young. And so that's kind of how I kind of confront things in life. I just kind of throw myself at them without really any kind of regard for long-term consequences, because I feel very animated by principles, animated by this struggle, basically. I couldn't just like be a normie and be aware of everything that's going on and not be in the fight. I just don't know how to do that kind of thing. So
I see Gino Fano on the regular chat says Matt is gay. Angry Sicilian says Matt is gay as fuck. You guys better be careful. You are on a mathematician stream. I don't take insults to Matt easily here. By the way, if you'd like to sup Matt, it's mathematics.
Oh, math.
I'm just a big fan of mathematics. I don't know why they insult Matt on the chat, but probably in reference to your over-philosophizing, which is a tendency that I've seen rise in 2016, 2018, 2019, those fascistic third rail super thinkers. And there's all sorts of flavors, some of them fascinated around structural politics like fascism, other on aesthetics and the Apollonians and the Hyperboreans. And I was like, what the fuck are these guys are over specialized? And it made me laugh this era because they develop a very dedicated fan base. And ultimately, these things are valued if they allow you to have some pillars of thought that you can then be pedagogical about, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I'm very passionate about really thinking through your worldview and being able to basically rationalize everything from first principles all the way up and to build expertise in all relevant fields that you can. But what's really important, I guess, is maintaining relevance to the struggle. I think sometimes people can go into these intellectual cul-de-sacs that become counterproductive. Also, I think people can over-intellectualize problems. Like one problem that I see in the scene a lot is this kind of genealogical thinking, where people say, oh, everything went wrong in like ancient Greece when we started having metaphysics, and that's what liberalism comes from, or it's Christianity, or it's like all these really like deep abstract problems, which is, I think is, you know, I think the simple Wignat, it's the Jews, actually explains reality much better than a lot of these other ideas. Like, and all of my intellectual work ended up kind of coming back around to that kind of, like, you know, like the, you know, the high-low, you know, the bell curve meme, you know, with, I think the two ends, it's the Jews, you know, the Wignat and the, you know, 180 IQ.
Don't make me also, tap the sign. It's the Jews.
I have. I'm going to start writing on this soon. Actually, about how a lot of the greatest, I think the majority of the greatest philosophers in the Western tradition were all massive racists and anti-Semites. I'm going to start writing a series on this because I think it's important to impress upon people that our tradition, that we inherit the Western tradition, actually is just a bunch of racists and anti-Semites spurging out. Like, it's us. Like, we are the true inheritors of Western intellectualism.
This is fascinating. It's fascinating because it's so much at the heart of my own revolution against the system. I was faced with arguments that I was like, this is not coherent. I was in academia. I was being peer-reviewed by others. I was like, this doesn't make sense. These people are judging my work based on fallacious reasoning, and then they apply different fallacious reasoning when they examine the world, the words of others. And I was listening to Jewish intellectuals like Sam Harris, and I was like, why is it that when it comes to a question like Israel or the Muslim question, their brain goes in a totally different direction than mine? And I was like, there needs to be an option out there for people to hear a white person's brain view and how it would converge on something like the Muslim question without the Jewish hate for Muslims.
Yeah, I was reading only just because in my research to write about you know, how anti-Semitic and racist the Western tradition is. Have you heard of the philosopher Frege? Frege, I think he basically invented or innovated philosophy of mathematics as a kind of individual discipline. He's the father, or at least the godfather of analytic philosophy, which now dominates the Anglo-American tradition, like the incredibly influential philosopher in the history of philosophy. But his politics, his political philosophy, no one really talks about. And so I looked into his political philosophy, and Frege died. He was a German. He died in the mid-1920s, but his political philosophy was this scathing critique of social democracy in the Weimar Republic from a Völkisch perspective, saying that social democracy and liberalism is based around self-interest and that it is a fundamentally Jewish mentality that alienates us from our Völkisch identity, and that for the Volk to rediscover a politics appropriate, they have to look to Christ, and Christ symbolizes self-sacrifice for one's people, as opposed to politics of self-interest, whether it be class interest for the Marxists and the social democrats or individual interest for the liberals. Instead, we need a politics of self-sacrifice to revive our kind of Völkisch spirit. And the Jews are kind of standing in the way of us and realizing this, which is why they killed Christ and so on. And I'm like, this is ridiculously based. I love this guy.
Seriously, I've never been as fascinated and as excited about an upcoming book. I think What you are doing is the most interesting work I've heard that has not been done yet that needs to be resolved. You know, I think of things like your theory seems to be, well, it's the Jews is an explanation that it always boils down to it. And you think of things like the COVID stuff where you have this whole branch of the internet that has specialized in, oh, well, are there blood clots and are there morticians that are capable of pulling worms out of blood vessels? And when you look at it, the whole COVID stuff has been promoted for the interest of pharma. And you also have a critique of pharma on the left and on the center right. But in the end, it boils down that it was a bunch of Jewish CEOs selling vaccines to you with the money that the state had taken from you, while the state was administered also by Jews. And you think, well, does it really matter how many blood clots you can count as a mortician? What matters is that the whole world has been basically the victim of a gigantic fraud committed for the enrichment of a few.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it's quite interesting when looking at, obviously, at foreign policy as well. I mean, it's like, you know, John Mearsheimer, he wrote a book on the Israel lobby with Stephen Walt, talking about how the Jewish lobby had basically taken over the United States. Keith Woods has a really good video called The Architects of the Iraq War, which if you haven't seen, the people at home, go and watch that video, because it talks about how the Iraq War, even the CIA was saying, oh, there's no weapons of mass destruction. We shouldn't be going to war with Iraq. Even the CIA was saying this. The oil companies didn't want to go to war with Iraq. This idea that it was for oil is totally just wrong. There's no evidence for that whatsoever. The oil companies were already in Iraq operating. Why did they need it to be invaded? But what happened was that you had these Jewish intellectuals, these Israeli intellectuals, that created a think tank in Israel in the mid-90s and then transplanted that think tank and all of its top staff into the United States. That became the project of the new American century. And then a lot of the top figures from that think tank go into the George W. Bush administration and create something called the Office of Special Plans, where they cook up all of this fake intelligence because the CIA won't give them what they want to justify going into Iraq, because this Israeli think tank back in the 1990s identified Saddam Hussein as the number one and his regime as the number one geopolitical threat to Israel. Had nothing to do with American interests whatsoever. It was just a total hijack of their political system. And that was so egregious. Like when I was young, because I mean, I'm 28, so the Iraq War was happening when I was, you know, quite young, but that was like the thing of the 2000s. It was like the big event. And that this group of people could just like force it into existence. And not only that, but like somehow escape culpability by creating this BS narrative that it was for oil or something. And that's just been like kind of swept into the dustbin of history. No one cares anymore. And we just all move on. It's like, well, wait a second, that costs trillions of dollars, countless lives. Someone needs to be held responsible for that. So there's just like so many things. You just break it down, the JFK assassination, 9/11, and so on. And you keep getting the same answer over and over again. It's the Jews. So,
and the great dogma of post-World War II America is you cannot scapegoat the Jews. It is the greatest sin of our current sociological era. And I'm tempted to extend your lens, the lens that you apply here, and say that all these alternative explanations, like the oil for Iraq, can they be perceived to some extent historically as a kind of cognitive dissonance deployment that people need to have to obfuscate themselves from the truth? When you have a Trump coming in and being so insistent on the idea that Iraq, it was all about the oil, I would have kept the oil. Isn't that Trump ultimately having a brain that cannot accept that it was Israel and Israeli interest in America?
Maybe, or maybe he knows it was Israel, but Israel, the ones who support his campaign, because he's a big Zionist, and he married off his daughter to one of these like criminal Jewish families and so on. So, what is he going to say? You know, that's the No, that's the other element here as well. It's like I saw Matt Walsh got groiped recently again, and I posted about this on my Telegram. It was posted up on Twitter by some Yay 24 page or something. But actually, someone in my Telegram chat dug up this old article from Matt Walsh from like 2013, where he's complaining about the Jewish lobby before he was working at the Daily Wire, which shows how he actually knows more than he lets on, and he is kind of self-censoring to work for the Daily Wire. And anyway, then I passed that on to Fuentes. Fuentes talked about it on his show. That kind of gave it some kind of mass awareness. I think Keith Woods did a big thread on it on Twitter or something, and it kind of got spread around. Some kid obviously saw that, showed up to one of Matt Walsh's events and groped him. And he said, you know, basically just referencing the article, you said this, 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 and this. Why don't you talk about this anymore? Is it because you work for Ben Shapiro and he won't let you, and so on? And Matt Walsh gave this answer of like, well, you know, I don't support foreign aid to any country. I think, you know, and it was kind of like he gave a, you know, a kind of quasi-based answer, but kind of evaded the real question, which is, it's not even just so much about giving foreign aid to Israel, because America can afford to do that if it wants to, if it found it in its interest to do so, or even if it didn't. The problem is not about the foreign aid. That's just, you know, a certain portion of its budget. The problem really is how the Jewish lobby controls the entire American right wing. And that means that the American right wing is basically censored, because anyone who would otherwise participate in right wing politics, who can't basically cuck to the Jews, who can't keep their mouth shut about the Jewish question, they get marginalized. And those are all the people that are also going to be nationalists, the most hardcore nationalists. So that marginalizes every virile white kind of nationalist or hardcore right-wing guy in American politics. And then so you have all of these homosexuals and cucks and sellouts and, you know, losers that kind of get elevated in the American right. And it creates this kind of selection mechanism that has been going on for decades that has totally cucked the entire conservative movement, where now Matt Walsh, who I'm just complaining about, is probably the most based guy in the entire mainstream conservative
movement. He is. He is.
At this point.
And I think that,
like, structural, like that, actually doing.
I think that the old comments you've exposed and you talked about from 2012 just shows he has the whole brain structure of a fully based man, but he has decided to make concessions. It's a strategy that, do you think it's always invalid to do that, to cock a little bit for the purpose? Let's say Matt Walsh has a positive contribution, say, on the trans question these days. Is it worth sacrificing the Jewish question so that you can expose the trans question the same way he does?
I don't know. Maybe, you know, I think Matt Walsh does do some good work. So, but at the end of the day, our job as radicals is to create pressure on these establishment figures. So even if we acknowledge that, we're still going to go and groip him. We're still going to hold his feet to the fire, because that's our job. We want Matt Walsh fans to see, who think Matt Walsh is the most based guy in the right wing, to see actually there's another option. Actually, there's more to the story. And we want Matt Walsh to feel the pressure. Like when he was on stage, you could see him kind of buckling and kind of, he didn't have that confident aura about him answering the question, because he knows that, he knows better, you know, he knows where that's coming from. So we want him to feel that. We want him to feel like he has to compensate for that. You know, recently he made some comments that were a little bit more throwing a bone to white identity politics and so on. We want him to do more of that. We want him to feel like he has to compensate by doing that kind of thing. So yeah, our job as radicals is to always maintain maximum pressure on these figures. Never relent, because no one else is going to do it but us.
Beautiful. And I love your explanation based on selection. Of course, yes, if you select people to have this JQ taboo, you select a bunch of very different brains from the one you would have attained otherwise. And it kind of destroys a meritocracy, and it creates an inverted meritocracy. Alimera sent a super chat. By the way, if you'd like to support the show, use the dollar button under the Odyssey chat. Odyssey super chats are my favorite way to receive support for the show. You're going to need to add a payment method in your Odyssey account for it to work. Alternatively, feel free to use Entropy. The link to Entropy is in the description below. Alimera sent the super chat and he says, have you guys heard of the forthcoming book by Jesse Kelly of Con Inc. entitled The Anti-Communist Manifesto? Finally, someone brave enough to confront and unmask those pesky commies. You're laughing. I haven't heard of that book.
It sounds terrible.
Yeah, it sounds very basic. You had your own critique of conservatives in a video called Conservatives Are Wrong About Cultural Marxism. If I was to summarize your view, tell me if I'm correct. You say Marxism was about ultimately an economic fight. It was about transforming philosophical and political ideology and funneling them down into a class consciousness. And that's fundamentally not what the cultural Marxism of modern times is with respect to gender, trans questions, and that kind of stuff. Is that correct?
Yeah. Do you want the longer you go view ahead. Or the shorter view?
Yeah, you go ahead.
Yeah, so the basic, I mean, like Marx himself, his theory is that what's called the base superstructure distinction. Because he is a materialist, a historical materialist, his view is that economic relations are more fundamental than ideology, more fundamental than our kind of consciousness of our social relations, our political views, our moral views. And so that basically because we are dominated by capitalism, that a kind of capitalist ideology that kind of supports and reflects that structure of social relations is imposed upon us. And that's what liberalism is. So it's not liberalism creating the system, but it's actually capitalism and specifically the domination of the bourgeoisie, the exploitation of the bourgeoisie, of the proletariat, that is generating this whole system. And then he has this theory of how kind of contradictions in the capitalist system, a theory which is scientifically incorrect, by the way, now we know for a fact. He had this theory of how there would be these kind of contradictions that would emerge within the capitalist structure that would ultimately lead to proletarian revolution, which would bring forth socialism. It would bring forth a new structure of economic relations and therefore a new kind of ideology. And that all attempts at just simply attacking the system as an ideology as opposed to as a structure of economic relations would fail because his theory of materialism says that it has to be the other way around. Now, this develops. So you get all these kind of splinter trajectories in Marxist thought in the 20th century because obviously you have the Marxist-Leninism of the Soviet Union and that whole trajectory. But you also have Western Marxism, which kind of splinters through two key theorists. One is Lukács, who was a Hungarian. And the other one was Antonio Gramsci, who was an Italian. Gramsci is the more interesting one because Gramsci's theory is kind of responding to fascism. He basically came up with this theory while, you know, Mussolini had him in jail for being a Marxist subversive. And he had to kind of come up with a theory as to why, instead of the communist revolution happening in Italy, why the fascist one instead? Why did the working class go with the fascists rather than the communists? This wasn't supposed to happen according to Marx's theory of history. And so he had to develop this notion of cultural hegemony, of this idea that, you know, it wasn't just so simple as this kind of base superstructure relationship, but actually the superstructure, the ideological superstructure, has more influence than Marx had previously thought, and that the kind of production of kind of nationalist ideology and so on in fascism bamboozled the proletariat and, you know, made them unable, put them into a state of false consciousness where they're unable to kind of recognize their kind of material exploitation and instead side with their oppressors. And so this develops in the kind of history of Western Marxism. Obviously, you have the end of the Second World War. And after the Second World War ends, and, you know, people see Stalinism in the West as this kind of totalitarian ideology that is kind of, you know, Trotsky gets exiled and there's the kind of Trotskyist breakaways and so on. There's this kind of growing kind of anti-Stalinist view in Western Marxism. And then after Stalin dies or is killed by the Jews, depending on, you know, how you want to analyze it, and Khrushchev takes over, he does the secret speech where he says, you know, Stalin was this terrible dictator and he sent tens of millions to the gulag, and you know, basically repudiates Stalin, and it begins this process of de-Stalinization. And so this blackpills a lot of people in the global conservative movements who start to view the Soviet Union as a failed project, and, you know, think that Marxism needs to kind of rethink itself in the West in a different way. Also, at the same time, capitalism is ascendant. It won, you know, it seems to be going great. You know, there's great prosperity in the kind of Keynesian, you know, post-World War II system of the United States and, you know, the other Western countries and so on. And so the working class isn't exactly impoverished. The working class is basically doing really well in the 50s and the 60s and so on. And so this idea of, like, you know, how do we get the working class to overthrow a system that seems to be that they love, that they support. And at the same time, there's the Frankfurt School, obviously, who were a bunch of Jewish intellectuals kicked out of Germany, who, you know, were just freaked out by what happened in National Socialist Germany. And so they were committed to preventing anything like that ever happening again in America or any other Western country. And so my argument is that within this context, the anti-fascist, anti-authoritarian nature of, you know, of the ideology takes precedent more and more over the kind of basic structure of original Marxism, which was so focused upon, you know, class war. It becomes less and less about class war. It becomes more about anti-fascism. It becomes more about, like, the cultural and ideological battle between different variants of, you know, Western liberalism and, you know, communism, as it, like, Stalinist communism and so on. It has to have all these critiques of all these new ideologies that didn't exist in Marx's time, and the kind of class warfare element becomes more and more de-emphasized through the decades, where the tradition, Marx, kind of Western Marxism and Western liberalism kind of just synthesize all the things in liberalism that were holding it back from embracing Marxism were kind of stripped from liberalism, and all the things in Marxism that held it back from being synthesized with liberalism, which was basically the kind of revolutionary class warfare of Marxism, get stripped, and they kind of homogenize into this new ideology, which is what we have now. And so focusing upon calling it communist, it really is kind of a misnomer, because, as I was saying in that video, the left cares more about being anti-white than it cares about anything else. Like, you can see this with the left today. Like, the left pretends to care about the environment, but then they'll import, you know, infinite immigrants into Western countries, even though it's bad for the environment. But we got to keep our emissions down at the same time somehow, or whatever. I mean, the left pretends to care about the working class, but importing all these migrants, you know, destroys the wages of the working class and actually benefits the capitalists, because it, you know, basically basic supply and demand increase the supply of labor, reduce the value, which is, you know, and also increases the cost of living, it increases the cost of housing and so on, which is terrible for the working class, but they care more about the anti-white agenda than about, you know, the interests of the working class. You know, the left claims to be feminist, but, you know, but they'll still import a bunch of Muslims into Western countries who are, you know, raping women in the streets and so on, and then suppress that and you know, basically make excuses for them and so on. So they only really care about, you know, protecting women if it doesn't conflict with racism. So, like, on every kind of thing that and the same thing with homosexuals, obviously. So every single thing that the left claims to care about all gets subordinated to the anti-white project of the left when push comes to shove. So, you know, I think you got to look at the priorities for what they are saying. What people like James Lindsay and so on, who are these conservatives, or they not even really conservatives, they're like classical liberals who pose as conservatives, or they pose as right wingers, and they say things like, you know, it's not really about race. The left is just using race to kind of dialectically create communism. It's really about creating communism. I think that's just not borne out by the evidence. I think communism is just an ideological excuse to be anti-white. I think that's more the other way around. So that was my overall analysis, that conservatives need to look at it as an anti-white ideology, an anti-fascist ideology, basically, more than it is a kind of a communist, quote unquote, ideology. Because
I love a part of your idea there. I think that one idea is very good, but I think you're also throwing the baby with the bathwater. So the idea that is very good and that people's mind need to be attracted to this, they need to pay attention. Yes, the anti-white project, which is at the emotional root of most attacks of the left, either consciously or unconsciously, whatever, is their priority. It takes over every other prior possibility. And I fully agree with you there. But we should not throw the baby with the bathwater and abandon the proper parallel in the way the Marxist attack on capitalism is has inspired a metaphorical overlap with the structure of the attack of the modern left on the family. When I see the attack in terms of, for example, trans, that is basically sterilizing the youngest possible people they can, the attack on the family through promotion of homosexuality, the attack on the family through feminism, I see the same mentality, the same ideological structure as Marxism, which was originally basically, hey, worker, you create these things, therefore you are entitled to profit. The fact that your boss takes profit is theft from you, and it is because of a capitalist structure. There's a perfect overlap between this structure and when the left today tells to the woman, look, you are entitled to control and power over your life, and in fact, even over your husband's life. You are entitled to destroy his life. You are entitled to deny him his children. And basically, what the same way the capitalism structure was justifying the taking of profits from the workers, the patriarchal structure justifies taking control away from women, especially, and you'll hear them say it explicitly when it comes to abortion and controls over abortion. So I think that this overlap should not be dismissed or missed.
I see what you're saying. You're saying like, oh, the basic kind of, like the patriarchy is substituted for capitalism, or white supremacy is substituted for capitalism, and there's a kind of a resemblance just with that substitution. But I guess my argument is that if you substitute out capitalism for anything else in Marxism, it becomes something radically different, because really the whole point of Marxism is this kind of fixation on political economy and this kind of fixation upon economic relations. That's really the essence of the theory. So if you substitute out like the most important and essential part of the theory for something else, it's an entirely different theory. And that's kind of where Marx's critique of liberalism, basically, I don't want to let liberalism off the hook here either, because Marx's critique of liberalism was really based in this kind of capitalist critique of liberalism. Liberalism has proven itself capable of adapting to destroying white supremacy and destroying the patriarchy and destroying heteronormativity, because it doesn't fundamentally attack, liberalism in the same way that communism did, because communism is fundamentally about, if we're going to get rid of the bourgeoisie, that means we need to have this massive bureaucracy to readminister, basically whatever worker control of the economy, whatever the hell that means. And obviously we do have this kind of liberal bureaucracy that exists now, or social democratic bureaucracy, whatever you want to call it. But I think it's fundamentally distinct, and it's a new thing. It's kind of like a radically different thing than what communism was. And I think when you kind of have this kind of conservative idea of we've got to fight communism, we've got to fight statism or something, and we've got to defend, like classical liberalism or something, it creates this kind of kosher dialectic where, the two alternatives are like CivNat individualism or this kind of identity politics of the left. And what I was trying to polemically say with that video was we should fight the collectivism of the left with our own collectivism, with right-wing collectivism, with white identity collectivism, as opposed to trying to fight it with individualism, which is what the conservative narrative is able to integrate a critique of communism into itself, and still it doesn't ideologically destroy it. Whereas if you racialize it, it's impossible for that kind of CivNat, classical liberal stance to really exist. It just gets like destroyed from the dialectic, or just like jettisoned from the dialectic. And even James Lindsay himself recognizes this, which is why he says, if you fight back with white identity politics, the left wins because then collectivism wins and we have to defeat collectivism. And it's like, I don't care about defeating collectivism. I care about white people winning. I don't care about liberalism winning, or I don't care if it's like radical, like super free market or full on communism. If white people are in charge, that's all I care about ultimately. Then once we're in charge, then we can argue between ourselves what kind of economic system we want. But I care more about the race war than about the class war. So
there's a demographic decline. In that demographic decline, do you say, let's say white people would become 20% of a country at some point. Do you advocate for white identity there as a kind of pressure group among the many pressure groups of minorities?
I mean, it's absolutely necessary. I mean, it only gets more necessary as time goes on. The more non-whites that are in the country, the more you need it, because it, like every other group does it. So you have no choice but to do it. It's basic. It's a basic necessity for self-defense at minimum. But the aspiration should be to increase our standing and our power, obviously. So, you know, Jews, we're just talking about Jews run our, you know, Jews are 0.4% of Australia's population. But Jews are a third of the billionaires, and their lobbyists have incredible influence over our government, despite being 0.4% of Australia's population. So minorities can be incredibly powerful if they're organized and self-conscious of their identity. So, we absolutely need white identity politics no matter what, and especially more the smaller and smaller as a percentage of the society that we become.
All right, some random bloke sends a super chat. He says, hello from Australia. Joel is spot on. Do you think that Marx was originally anti-white, or is it an ideological movement that has been used by anti-whites to attack whites? Many Marxists abandoned it when it was no longer useful and became neoconservatives when that ideological movement was useful.
I don't think Marx was particularly anti-white. I mean, there's like a funny quote, some correspondence between him and Engels when the Americans defeated the Mexicans in, I can't remember, you know, which war it was, but, you know, around the time of, in the mid 19th century, and they took California and Texas and so on. And Marx and Engels were like, you know, great. There's basically moral, I'm paraphrasing, but like the way the Americans will civilize the place, and they were very happy. They had this kind of white supremacist stance. Also, Marx said basically that blacks were incapable of being part of the proletariat because they were too stupid to ever form class consciousness or whatever. So Marx was he was hardly this kind of critical race theory. That wasn't Marx. So, yeah, but Marx, I'm not saying that Marx was like some like based, you know, our guy either. He wasn't. But because it was just simply the standards of his time. Like in the 19th century, everyone was racist.
It was a regular European racist. And perhaps was he even anti-Jew to some extent? He may have made some comments that today might be interpreted as anti-Semitic.
Well, I think from what I can understand about Marx's view, because obviously Marx was Jewish, but Marx's view, he was against the religion of Judaism because he was an atheist, like a secular guy, a materialist. And I think basically what he wanted was for the Jews to be kind of genetically absorbed into Europe. It doesn't matter if you're Jew or Gentile. What matters is that you're part of the working class. And, you know, if the working class overthrows the proletariat, institutes socialism, we're all in this together as like one. We're all Germans. We're all workers, you know, whatever. Again, he wouldn't even say we're all Germans because he thought nationalism was bad, but he had this kind of internationalist, you know, worker identity that he was driving at. So some people say that, you know, you can look at like communism and Zionism as these two Jewish strategies. You know, one Jewish strategy to deal with their difference is to destroy their difference by kind of being absorbed into the host. And the other strategy is to, you know, create their own state to protect their difference. And that's Zionism. And he kind of criticized the Zionists because obviously there were Zionist intellectuals already around in his time that he interacted with. So I wouldn't say that he was anti-Jewish, because you could see how communism in a certain sense is in the Jewish self-interest, like, you know, in order to kind of overcome their marginalization, interbreeding and being absorbed into the white race would be one solution that would be preferable to like just being stuck in the shtetl and being marginalized and kicked out of more countries and so on ad infinitum. But yeah, that's my impression of his views.
And to answer the super chat, I think that the Jewish hate for white people stems from perhaps three different interactions with host societies, mainly the modern one at least. The failed experiment of communism in USSR, the failed experiment of a control over Europe with Germany in World War II, and then the failed experiment of penetrating the American, say, Christian center of America, to the extent that the Jews have been successful at establishing a bureaucratic technocracy in the big centers, but they have felt the backlash from a form of Christian resistance in terms of social conservatism to their attack on family. And I think the Jews look at this and they're like, okay, at this point we have understood our great utopic project for how we would want to manage society will always come to be an obstacle. There would always be an obstacle to it, and it will be the people's root, the white people forming the communities that we want to take over.
Yeah, of course. You know, it's interesting, like in the history of the Soviet Union, after the Second World War and the State of Israel is created, originally the Soviet Union recognizes it. I think it was the first state to recognize the State of Israel. There were a lot of Jews, obviously, in Soviet Russia, who were big supporters of Israel. But then Stalin immediately started to become suspicious of the Zionists, how they were kind of more, they cared more about the State of Israel than they cared about the Soviet Union, and their loyalty was to Israel, not to the Kremlin. And at the same time, the Americans recognized the State of Israel and were, you know, had very close relations, and they didn't trust that. So then they quickly flipped, and they started supporting the Egyptians, and arming the Egyptians and so on. And Stalin started purging Zionists and started, this 5-year campaign of repressing Zionists, because he viewed Zionism as this subversive ideology in Soviet Russia. And a lot of people think the Zionists ultimately killed Stalin. But, you know, it's a contentious topic. And, you know, that kind of the parallel to that ultimately was, you know, the Trotskyists and other kind of elements that ended up forming the neoconservatives and so on. And Jews started to realize that actually, you know, communism wasn't as good for Jews as liberalism is, because in liberalism, you don't need to be directly in control to be in control or to have some control, at the very least. Whereas under like the Soviet Union, if Stalin decides that he's got a problem with you, you're kind of screwed unless you kill Stalin. He's coming for you. He's going to put you in the gulag, right? Whereas in the American system, there is no Stalin figure that can clamp down on you, because it's the American system, the liberal system is run by NGOs and think tanks and media organizations. And it's all privatized. So if you can control a large portion of the financial system, you can kind of buy up the media and fund all these NGOs and foundations and think tanks, and you can set the policy agenda, you can fund political campaigns. You don't have to directly run the country to really influence it. And this, if you're a minority, that's a much better system for you to kind of operate with it. So the Jews adapted much better to the American system then ultimately to the communist system, even though they were instrumental in setting it up. Obviously, the Bolsheviks, a very large portion of the Bolsheviks, I think more than half of the Bolshevik leadership originally was Jewish at the time of the Russian Revolution. But ultimately, that system just didn't suit them as a strategy, like how they were able to kind of work within American or Anglo-American liberalism. And so their loyalty kind of shifted. And now, you know, now increasingly Jews are loyal to this Anglo-American system, this kind of liberal internationalist order, more and more. You know, any kind of authoritarian centralization of state power, they fear, because another Stalin could emerge, even if they're the ones that are kind of doing it.
Or another Hitler. It was suggested today by a next Twitter blue check mark, Julie Maynor, was saying, as a former blue check journalist, today is a difficult day. Despite my relatively low follower account, I've been able to share verified information for important conversations. What Elon Musk did, removing blue checks, is no different than what the Nazi party did to journalists. How have you been experiencing the takeover of Elon Musk, and particularly today, the disappearance of the legacy blue check marks?
Yeah, well, as I say, Heil Elon, Heil our people, has been my line. The Musk Reich, I've been calling it, ever since he took over. And a lot of people were saying, you know, Joel, you're delusional. Elon Musk is a cuck. You know, nothing's going to change. And I was like, no, I think there's some opportunity here. It's not going to be perfect. You know, you're probably not going to be able to deny the Holocaust on Twitter, but it will improve. It will be much better than it was. I was like, it can't get any worse than it was. And I feel totally vindicated. And I got my blue check mark. I paid my $8 a month for my blue check mark because it just makes you, it just carries extra gravitas. There's obviously some benefits. You can have like longer tweets and so on. It seems to improve your engagement. I think it increases the likelihood that you won't get banned as well. I think they're probably less likely to ban a check mark, you know, paid subscriber, I would think. And so, you know, I think it's great. And I think also the kind of democratization, the abolition of the legacy blue checks and so on is only a further improvement. I'm sure most blue check, some of them are trying to take a principled stand. I'm not going to pay for the blue check and so on. Like as if anyone cares, which is kind of sad, but you know, I think most celebrities and so on would just pay for it because for status reasons. So I think he's making the right move there. And I think ultimately, the platform is vastly improved. Not like technically, there's been a lot of glitches with the code, but I think in terms of like, obviously the kind of freedom of speech and the algorithm and so on, it's vastly better. So,
but these glitches, they don't worry me because to me, they show the experimental nature of Elon Musk. These glitches, they appear, but then you see them disappear very quickly. And so that's a sign that the platform is actually progressing. There had been bugs in Twitter video, for example. There had been bugs for years that they wouldn't never fix. Elon takes over, and within a month, it was all fixed. Now I can play Twitter videos without them arbitrarily pausing without reason. So to me, these bugs, I welcome them because I know that 24 hours later, they disappear. Claude Warmer sends a super chat. He says, what are Joel's thoughts on the Aboriginal voice to Parliament? Would he think this has a basis in radical Marxism, like what has been seen in the various civil rights movements throughout the rest of the world? What is the end goal here, aside from the obvious? Further changes to the Constitution?
The voice to Parliament in Australia. I just posted a thread about this on Twitter, so people should go and like and retweet that so that it can get some traction and read what I had to say. I'll address the Marxism thing first before I get into the details. I mean, I think it's more based in critical race theory, seems to be really kind of influential over the thinking of these activists, so that you know, the previous discussion we had about how Marxist critical race theory is can apply to that. But as for the voice itself, the voice comes from something called the Uluru Statement of the Heart. I hate calling it Uluru because my people call it Ayers Rock, and then they changed it to this other name, which is this kind of it's quite a famous kind of rock that's in the middle of the desert, in the middle of the country, that they declare as sacred for some reason. But anyway, they had a kind of Aboriginal activist conference there a few years ago, and they came up with an action plan for basically how to have reconciliation with the Aboriginals, because they claim that they never ceded sovereignty to the crown, and so there's something fundamentally illegitimate and racist about the Australian state as it currently exists. And so they came up with three basic kind of prescriptions: what they call a voice, what they call a treaty, and what they call a truth commission, which presumably be kind of presided over by the voice in some way, and the voice is the first element of this. And so how the government is selling it to the people is, Aboriginals need to be recognized in the Constitution, and they need, like, Aboriginals have issues that specifically affect them, and so they need to have a specific form of representation that can represent their specific interests and deal with their issues in their own communities, because the rest of us don't know what all the kind of don't have the same knowledge of the specific issues that relate to them that they have. And so they're just making it this very loose thing. It's just going to be this advisory body. It's nothing to worry about. It, like, ultimately it'll be under the authority of the parliament. But the thing is that if that's the case, why does it need to be in the Constitution? There already is, like, so many advisory bodies, some of which are actually directly related to Aboriginal issues, that already exist. The government can take advice from anyone that it wants to. Anyone can give the government advice. I could give the government advice. They don't have to listen to me, of course, but anyone can advise the government. So why does an advisory body need to be put in the Constitution? It doesn't really make any sense. And if you look at the specific wording of how it's described, they say the voice will have the right to make representations to the parliament and to the executive government, meaning so it can talk to all the parts of the government, you know, government bureaucracy, without going through the parliament or going through the actual kind of elected leadership of the government. On matters relating to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. So what that means, make representations, is quite ambiguous, because, you know, to make present the voice's concerns implies, you could argue, implies that they should be listened to. And so if they make a suggestion to the government and the government rejects the suggestion, they could go to the High Court, which is our version of the Supreme Court, and potentially argue before some left-wing activist set of judges we haven't been able to make our voice present because they rejected our proposal. And you get one ruling from the High Court agreeing with that in one specific instance, and that would set a precedent where now the government is basically subject to this body and whatever it wants to kind of demand. Also, because it comes from the Uluru Statement of the Heart, which I mentioned previously, that had all this other stuff about reparations, when they're having these referendum council meetings with the people that are kind of behind the voice, they talk about how Australia, we got a country for free and we still haven't paid for it. They talk about how they want reparations where a portion of our GDP has to be paid to them. They want to tax the entire GDP of the whole country, which is crazy. They want to change the flag because apparently it's racist because it has a Union Jack in it. They want truth commissions. They want to completely... I mean, the school system has already been changed by these people to make it like anti-white supremacist and white man bad and the poor Aboriginals. And they want to change it even more because it's not anti-white enough. And they want taxes. They want quotas and everything. I mean... they're radical extremists who believe that Aboriginals need sovereignty. They explicitly say in these meetings, even though they're telling us it's just going to be an advisory council, relax, this is a scare campaign from the right wing saying that it's going to have any actual power. But then if you look at the documents from the meetings of the people who are pushing this in the referendum council, they explicitly say that the body can't just be an advisory body. It needs to have actual power. Aboriginals need to have sovereignty. How can you have a government where there's two claims to sovereignty? You've got the Crown's claim to sovereignty, which is transferred to the people because it's an Anglo-Saxon country. And then you've got this Aboriginal claim to sovereignty. You can't have two sovereignties within one system. Ultimately, any decision, some power has to win out against another in any dispute. So this is just sending a minefield to the courts, and the courts are totally untrustworthy. The courts, much like in the United States, where you have, you know, Supreme Court decisions that they reinterpret the Constitution 200 years later to say that actually the Constitution says that you can get an abortion, or the Constitution says you can have gay marriage and all this nonsense. That kind of thing happens here too. And so that's how I see this going if the referendum gets up, where, you know, they basically are hoodwinking us to slip it through. It's just about constitutional recognition. It's just about them having a voice. They don't have any power. And then once it's in the constitution, you need a referendum to get rid of it. And you could imagine a situation in which, like, the voice, if it is empowered, could actively block a referendum or something in the future so that it could never be abolished, saying that a referendum would be a violation of its sovereignty or something. And so we could probably never get rid of it if it goes through. So it's deeply disturbing. It is like an existential question on the future of the country, really.
Yeah, now that you lay it out, I think it's very dangerous. It's the creation of a special class, and it's a constitutional shortcut of that special class, right? Potentially over everyone, if they do get their way with the taxes. I thought that it was about sovereignty, and at first I was like, well, Aboriginal sovereignty, I'm all for it. But sovereignty is also having to live with yourself and having to live with the consequences of your action and not living off the actions of others. And it does seem that if they gain a kind of special entry into constitutional mechanism, that then it's more than sovereignty. It's really domination.
Yeah, we have precedent for this as well with what's happened in New Zealand. So in New Zealand, they had a treaty with the Maori, you know, that they signed to end hostilities like back in the middle of the 19th century. And the treaty was quite simple. It transferred sovereignty entirely to the crown. It gave all the Maori full citizenship as British subjects, because obviously the empire still existed back then. The crown still officially is sovereign over both countries to this day, obviously. And also, it gave like the Maori the right to kind of maintain ownership of their land. It was a very simple treaty. It only had three clauses. And then, you know, over 100 years later, this Waitangi Commission or whatever was established, which is equivalent to the Voice in many respects, which was only supposed to be an advisory body to represent the Maori people to kind of administer this treaty and just not administer it even, just kind of make rulings on it and interpret it and put forward the Maori's case of how the treaty should be interpreted. But it was only supposed to advise the government. And then the Supreme Court or the High Court in New Zealand reinterpreted their powers so that they basically preside over the treaty and could block the government in various respects, including foreign policy, like full spectrum stuff that's way beyond the scope of the treaty. They've made rulings on because it's in the spirit of the treaty, so to speak, according to these judges. So that's a really kind of that kind of because it's New Zealand, it's such a similar country to Australia, that kind of shows what we're in store for here if this passes. And I think in Canada there's been similar issues. I don't know as much about the Canadian situation. You would probably know more than me about that. Yeah, this is a disaster. Luckily, though, like when they first announced this last year, the polling showed like massive support for the yes vote because no one really understood the details. It all sounded very innocuous and just kind of like, oh, we're just recognizing the Aboriginals. And it seemed like a ceremonial gesture. And the more that it's become politicized, because the referendum will be at the end of the year, the more that it's kind of been in the news cycle and it's become contentious, every poll they do, the yes vote drops more and more and the no vote increases. And now it's almost at parity. This recent poll that I saw that came out overnight, where there's six states in Australia, only three need to vote no to stop it. And the no vote was winning in two out of six states. And in the other states, there was so many undecided voters that all the other states are up in the air. And we're still such a long way out. The campaign has barely got into motion. It was only 2 weeks ago that the Liberal Party, which is our conservative party, announced that they were actually going to officially oppose like campaign for the no vote. And then all the Jews in the shadow cabinet all stepped down immediately because they all support it, funnily enough. Yeah, the conservatives campaigning against it, I think it's more likely now that the no vote will win because of the argument that I just described becoming more conscious in the population as time goes on.
All right. Eugen Greenbeard says, how do you cope with the profound stupidity of most people? They can hear great points like those made here and still default back to Jewish propaganda. Are they fundamentally incapable of understanding or just conformist cowards?
I think a lot of people just don't go too far beneath the surface in their own thinking. They don't challenge their own thinking very much. They subsist on emotion and intuition. I notice this a lot when trying to debate. I try to engage people on Twitter sometimes in arguments or around like the trans issue or the gay, like kind of gay marriage issue or something, stuff that everyone on our side already agrees with. And it might seem pointless to argue about it for the umpteenth time, but just to kind of see if I inquire into this, into my kind of interlocutor here, how much substance is behind their view? Like, have they really kind of got anything there? And there's nothing there every time. I was in an argument. So I posted this video the other day on Twitter. It was of Alex Jones. I don't know if you saw this, JF, but Alex Jones was basically saying that, you know, if you turn 18, if you want to chop your dick off and have a sex change surgery, he supports it. He's a libertarian. You want to kill yourself, fine, bodily autonomy, but we just can't have kids doing it because that's the only problem. That's where we draw the line. So 18th birthday, dick comes straight off. It's fine.
I agree with this as a libertarian. Yeah, because, I mean, don't stop people from self-sterilizing. Never do this. Stupidest thing to do evolutionarily. Someone here is volunteering to eugenize themselves outside of existence. Why would you object?
Well, I would object on moral grounds that I think I'm not a libertarian. My view is that freedom is something that can only be a product of rationality. Because if you don't have a kind of rational control of your own behavior, that means your behavior is governed by emotion, by passion, which means you're not free. You're a slave to these passions and emotions. Freedom has to be the product of a kind of rational evaluation of how you should act. And chopping your dick off is entirely irrational. So if you want to engage in a behavior like that, you should be subordinated to someone who is rational to take care of your body and control your behavior until such time as you regain your rationality.
But my problem here is that makes you a cuck. You are spending energy guiding someone else toward a reproductive life. You are just as much as the bird caring for the little eggs of the other bird because he got fooled by their appearance. You are spending energy on other genes, and it's an unsustainable system. And I would say that's irrational. It's irrational to want a class of humanity to be dependent on the fascistic guides to behave properly. Let them disappear.
But this presupposes, though, that the everything that every kind of stupid decision people make is simply an outcome of their genetics. But I don't think that's true, because if the same people that are becoming transgender or whatever now existed 100 years ago, they wouldn't become transgender. They would just be normal people.
Exactly. The corruption. So they had a kind of crutch. Now they lost the crutch. They were unfit for the world. They were unfit for a world in which they would be exposed to that much propaganda. But let them be unfit.
No, I disagree. I think ultimately a just society needs to be administered. This would be true. Any, in order to have a good society, there simply is no way to humanity is fundamentally frail and retarded. It's not actually capable of moral life without direction. And in fact, we acknowledge this too, because we have this thing called parenting. We don't say, oh, let the five-year-old do whatever it wants and let its genetics figure out if it's going to make good or bad decisions. We acknowledge it's a five-year-old, it's stupid, it needs to have parental direction. Why do we arbitrarily, when someone turns 18, just end that and say, now you're totally free? I think agency should be something that is demonstrated, something that is cultivated before it is acknowledged, as opposed to just arbitrarily assigned at a random age cutoff point.
Well, the way I see it is that the parents' genes are caring for themselves in the children, because the children carry their genes. But if it was the case that children need to be cared for by the community, I would say definitely don't do this. Definitely that's a misaligned genetic system. As far as the arbitrary age of 18, it is an arbitrary choice, I agree. And it's an arbitrary choice because we need to put a line. We need to put a line where the person's decision will be more honored by society than than their ancestors.
Well, I think there's also other issues here as well, because there's externalities to these things. So the decision to become a transsexual doesn't just affect you personally. It affects a whole series of people around you. And it ultimately, it affects society in general, as we're seeing now with the normalization of transgenderism. Also, it benefits a bunch of very evil people. So the people who do, there's a whole industry around transgender surgeries, of psychologists convincing people that they should get transgender surgeries and so on. They shouldn't be, you know, rewarded with, you know, six-figure jobs like they are under our society. Just like a heroin dealer shouldn't be rewarded, or, you know, any of these other kind of perverse and degenerate kind of professions. And you know, you could say, well, the heroin addict, they just have defective genes. Why are you getting addicted to heroin? You should just stay sober. I didn't need a law against heroin to stop me from doing heroin. Why do you need it? But then on the other hand, you could say, well, this is creating an entire industry around selling heroin. And also all these heroin addicts are like robbing people's houses and robbing people's cars and so on to get their next fix. And so there's all of this damage that's being done to wider society as a result of allowing this immorality to perpetuate and sustain itself. To me, I think we have a responsibility to maintaining the moral order for the sake of everybody else that it affects as well, as opposed to like, let's just let our entire society like degenerate and our civilization to collapse for some kind of eugenic experiment.
All right. Well, we disagree. I'm all in for the experiment. Some random bloke says, does Joel think we need to try to expose the Jewish Aboriginal Alliance in that the powerful Jewish forces are siding with Aboriginals to push this anti-white agenda, but are fiercely anti-indigenous for the Palestinians? Their hypocrisy is beyond the charts.
Yeah, I posted about this on Twitter, and also I do a show every Thursday night at 8 p.m. Australian Eastern Time on a separate YouTube channel, which is called The Joel and Blair Show. I stream with Blair Cottrell, who's another Australian nationalist, and we cover Australian issues. And we did an episode last night, but the previous week, the episode was called The Jewish Voice to Parliament, or Mark Liebler's Jewish Voice to Parliament, and we got into the Australian JQ, basically. So the principal architect of The Voice is this guy who is, he's a corporate lawyer. Basically, he's a Jewish corporate lawyer. He basically made his money and built his kind of reputation through helping wealthy Jews dodge taxes. So his law firm, they have the accounts of like 20% of the richest, you know, 200 Australians. Basically all the Jewish billionaires use this law firm to dodge taxes. And he developed a lot of kind of prestige in the Jewish community. And he is now like the number one Jewish, like Zionist lobbyist in Australia. He runs like the Australian version of AIPAC. He's the president. He used to run the Zionist Organization of Australia. He's in the World Zionist Council. He's this very super influential, massive Zionist figure and has strong personal relationships with every prime minister since the 80s. And one prime minister, Kevin Rudd, who was a Labour prime minister about 10 years ago or so, who upset him, he basically got replaced and installed in a kind of hostile kind of leadership coup, Australia's first and only female prime minister, Julia Gillard, to replace him, which they ended up having to switch it back before the election.
They love doing this. Unpopular. They love getting the woman in as the replacement, as the tyrannical replacement.
Yeah, but he, so he is a super, super influential and massive hardcore Zionist, won't tolerate any criticism of the state of Israel whatsoever, promotes Zionism, like he basically promotes Zionist schools just for Jews to send their kids to get get indoctrinated as Zionists. They become passionate Zionists and boast about how Australian Jews are the most Zionist kind of country in the Jewish diaspora in the world because of all of these programs to Zionize them, basically. But at the same time, he is the leading advocate of the leading non-Aboriginal advocate of Aboriginal rights in Australia. So settler colonialism for Israel is great, but in Australia, the poor Aboriginals need their sovereignty. The crown is evil. It's a ridiculous double standard. It's such an egregious double standard, yet he somehow maintains it. He's a leader in the kind of referendum council. a massive public advocate for The Voice, has been for years, also instrumental in supporting the politicians that facilitated the process in the first place to even bring it to the point where now it's a referendum. And so, yeah, it's a very egregious example of the Australian Jewish question. Jews are always at the kind of core of all the terrible things that have happened in our history. The White Australia policy was basically destroyed by Jews infiltrating the immigration department, because the White Australia policy was more fundamentally bureaucratic than legal, because we wanted to put it in our constitution originally after Federation, because Australia was founded by white nationalists. Everyone was a white nationalist in Australian politics for the first, you know, 50 plus years of our existence. And they wanted to put in our constitution the White Australia policy. But the reason why they didn't was because the British wouldn't have liked it, and we were still part of the British Empire, because it wasn't politically correct and it would upset certain other international figures and so on. And so instead they did it through bureaucracy. So the bureaucracy was incredibly racist. They actually had people in the Australian immigration bureaucracy who would analyze the photos of European applicants for immigration. And if they looked Jewish, they would reject them. This was literally a job. You had like professional Judas in the Australian government. So they basically had all these racist guys kind of administering bureaucratically this policy. They would give like English language tests yet to pass to immigrate to Australia. And if you didn't seem desirable, if you weren't a Northern European, they would just make the test ridiculously hard so like no one could pass, as just a way to, you know, bureaucratically get rid of you. Jews infiltrate this, the whole immigration bureaucracy, and ultimately destroy it, turn it over. And Walter Lippmann, an Australian Jew, was the father of the whole policy of multiculturalism that came in the 70s and opened up the floodgates. And this is a common story. So, but Mark Liebler is probably the most powerful Jew in Australia today, the most influential. And it is particularly egregious, this double standard, of course.
All right. And we have a last super chat before we go toward the conclusion of the show. Aquanote says, but who determines what is rational, Joel, in reference to your earlier statement about society needs to be guided by rationality? He says it will inevitably fall in the hands of the very people who hate us today.
What are the people who hate us? The ideology that we're ruled by is fundamentally irrational. I think if you really engaged in a kind of a rational attempt at moral realism, you would have to come to a kind of teleological conception of morality, in which case you would have to be staunchly opposed to things like transgenderism, homosexuality, and you would have to kind of have a support for ethno-nationalist principles and so on. So I think actually, no, I think my worldview is rational, and I think the enemy's worldview is irrational.
All right. And as we head toward the conclusion, I want to say I have a great respect for you as a thinker. What you've laid out tonight is some of the best interview in terms of the intelligence of your understanding of society. I am absolutely floored by the quality of your thoughts, and absolutely excited about your book. Is it a book that you're writing, or is it something else?
No, I'm just going to throw it up. I'm going to throw up some Substacks. I haven't done Substack yet. I wanted to get into Substack recently. I was originally going to launch, I had a journal previously that I published with Imperium Press back in 2021. We put out 3 issues, and then I wasn't really happy with that project, and it got derailed, and the person funding it abandoned it, and so on. And I was going to create a new journal project, which was going to be kind of around ethno-nationalist, ethno-political themes, intellectual work in that space. And organizing writers into a coherent project was like herding cats. It was so frustrating and annoying that I decided, fuck everybody else. I'm just going to write my own stuff and not spend any more time worrying about trying to get other people to write. I'm just going to put things out, make it available to people. And I would like to write a book one day, but the shorter form, I think, suits me better for now. And then a lot of the ideas that I work out in shorter form will probably end up being spun into more elaboration down the track.
All right. Well, you let me know when that Substack is available, because that theory of the kind of secret anti-Semite in every European thinker, I think it touches on a very important point that I've never seen truly addressed. But I would suggest that this is such a big idea that you would benefit from creating a book like this. And a Substack, of course, is good to have continued subscriber and exposure to your big fans. But a book is money that you're going to make for the rest of your life. It sleeps there. You don't have to do anything. It's passive income, and you can even give it to your children if it becomes an important book. So consider the idea, at least if you do these short Substack posts, to eventually collect them into a book. I think it's a very important
idea. Well, I definitely have the ambitions to write a book. And it wouldn't just be a collection of the Substack posts. Substack, by virtue of the medium, you would not go into the same kind of detail that you would in a book.
Exactly.
But it could be a way to kind of start fleshing out certain ideas, building up a reputation and so on, so that a more complex form in a book, there'd be more of an audience for it, and I'll be more seasoned, and some of the ideas would already be worked out. So that's probably the natural trajectory that I'm on here, I think.
Wonderful. As a last question before we close the show, Elon Musk has thrown his rocket toward the sky, but it started rotating. The Starship has exploded in mid-flight. Elon Musk did not expect a big success on this, but it was a test flight. Are you excited about space exploration? Is there a future for white people in space?
I'm not excited about it, no. I think basically the only point to space exploration or to space programs is just to build better weapon systems. It's not really, there's nothing really up there that's very close, that's that useful. So
yeah. I agree. All right, for everyone joining us tonight, thank you so much for being here. And thank you, Joel, for joining us. Very kind of you. And we'll talk again in the future.
Yeah, thanks, man.
Bye-bye.